Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming to another live stream for The Left Lens. This is the third straight. We don't generally do this, but we have a special guest tonight. Before we get to Scott Ritter, our special guest tonight, please do hit that like button. Make sure that you're subscribing to the channel, that you're sharing the stream. Hitting that like button helps boost this conversation, boost this video in the algorithm. So please do that. And of course, to sustain this work, sustain my journalism and this channel, patreon.com/DannyHaiFong is the place to do that. But I'm going to get right to it because we have a lot to talk about because this is a huge issue. I haven't covered this in a little while, but I think it is about time that I do. So I wanted to bring on somebody as knowledgeable as possible about it, about what's going on with the Russia-Ukraine conflict, with the Ukraine war. And it is Scott Ritter. He's a former U.S. Marines intelligence officer. He's also a former U.N. weapons inspector. And he has been really just going around all independent media. I see you a lot, Scott, really giving voice to, I think, a perspective that isn't heard in the mainstream Western media. So thank you for coming on to the channel. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course, of course. Well, let's get right to it. I mean, there have been, even just in the last couple of days, Biden sent another $1 billion in military aid to Ukraine. We had the European leaders, Germany, France, Italy, and I believe it was Romania, who went to see to meet with Zelensky. So what do you what's happening right now? Could you give an update about what the status of the war? Because we hear so many different things in the Western media, but the main line is kind of like, don't worry about Ukraine. Ukraine's doing okay. But lately there's been some, I don't know if it's Freudian slips or just some little indications that things may not be going so well for Ukraine. But I want to know what your opinion is on sort of the status of the war. Where are things? And, you know, wars are about winners and losers. So what's happening there?
Well, I mean, first of all, let's start off with what you said. Wars are about winners and losers. Yeah, in general. But, you know, sometimes I'll give you an example. When Hezbollah fights Israel, Hezbollah wins by not losing. They don't win by winning. Hezbollah hasn't defeated Israel and isn't going to defeat Israel. But Hezbollah wins by not being defeated by Israel. So when we talk about, you know, Russia and Ukraine, understand that regardless of the rhetoric that you hear from, you know, Zelensky and his advisors, Ukraine is not going to beat Russia. They're not going to kick Russia out. But Ukraine can win this conflict by not losing. And that's sort of where we're at right now with, you know, what the West is focused on. You know, they've been selling us a line of goods about, you know, how the Ukrainians have been killing the Russians by the bushel full and destroying more tanks than Russia is ever able to produce. It's all been lies. Yeah, the Russians are suffering casualties. It's war. It's not just war. It's the kind of war that hasn't been fought for decades. You know, the United States hasn't fought a war of this operational scale and magnitude since the Korean conflict. I mean, even Vietnam, for its length and in size, didn't have the intensity, the sustained intensity that is you know, ongoing in Ukraine today. The Russians are in control. That's the one thing that everybody needs to understand. You know, the Russians have been very reticent about sharing information about what their goals and objectives are. They've put out some very broad brush objectives, denazification, they call it, that ultimately is going to mean not just the physical destruction of the ultra-nationalist, right-wing, neo-Nazi-affiliated military formations, but also the political parties and the ideology. Russia is going to insist on constitutional changes in whatever form the Ukrainian state takes once this conflict is finished, that ban the celebration of people like Stepan Bandera, who is currently the national hero of Ukraine, an old-time Ukrainian nationalist who fought side by side with Nazi Germany during the Second World War. His troops are responsible for the slaughter of tens of thousands of Jews, hundreds of thousands of Poles, hundreds of thousands of Russians, because they believe they are the super race. The Nazi Germans liked the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Western Ukrainians. They called them fellow Aryans, and they actually took thousands of the Ukrainian children and shipped them back to Germany so that they could improve the breeding stock of Germany. I mean, that this is what we're talking about here. This is modern day extension of the Nazi ideology that I had been led to believe by history. My grandfather and the grandfathers of the Russians and the French and the British had united to defeat back in 1945. But no, it's alive and well and living, and sadly being supported by the United States, Great Britain, France. It sickens me, to be honest, that this is taking place. But Russia has talked about denazification. They've also spoken of demilitarization, and that is any NATO infrastructure, any NATO, any vestige of NATO, whether it be training, organization, equipment, will be eliminated. Ukraine will not have any vestige of NATO remaining. Their military will be dismantled and cleansed of all NATO-affiliated accoutrements. All this equipment that we're sending in, the billions of dollars of equipment, will either end up being destroyed by Russia or captured by Russia. So the Russian taxpayers thank the American taxpayers for gifting them tens of billions of dollars of our most advanced weaponry, because Russia will own this. And then the last one is, of course, that Ukraine must be neutral in perpetuity. Ukraine can never join NATO. These are Russia's goals, and Russia has said repeatedly, the special military operation will not end until all goals are met. And Russia's serious. I think the one thing we can agree upon about Russia is that they don't bluff. There's no bluff here. They just say it, then they do it. It's called a special military operation for a reason. It's not a war. If it was a war, we would have general mobilization and millions of Russians, and this would have been over a long time ago. But Russia did not want to go to war against Ukraine. They wanted to launch a special military operation against the Nazis, against NATO, and against those political elements in Ukraine that were empowering the Nazis and NATO. This was not intended to be a war against the Ukrainian people or the Ukrainian nation. The fact that it has transformed into one is the fault of Ukrainian government and NATO. You know, the provision of these heavy weapons are going to be a suicide pill for Ukraine. As I said, Russia is winning. Russia is in control. Russia has been dominating the kill ratio from day one. When this war first started, Russia was killing the Ukrainians at a rate of around 6-1. That is, for every Russian who died, they were getting 6. That number's up probably in the area of 15-20-1. That is, for every 15 to 20 Ukrainians die, one Russian dies. And this is good for Russia because the special military operation only came in with around 200,000 troops. Now, Russia has suffered some dead and some wounded. The exact numbers are unknown, but I would guess that we're talking in the area of combined dead and wounded, close to 40,000. It's significant. But Russia has brought in 40 to 60,000 reinforcements. So their force levels remain about the same. Ukraine started with 260,000 regular forces, around 300,000 reservists. They've since then mobilized over 700,000 men. So, you know, there's a lot of guys on the ground fighting in a very large territorial expanse, but Russia is in control. They're grinding the Ukrainians down. This has become an artillery war, and artillery is the king of battle, and Russia is the king of artillery. To give you an example of why Ukraine will never win this fight, one only has to realize that today Ukraine is firing about 5,000 to 6,000 artillery rounds a day. That's a lot. That's a lot. Russia's firing around 60 to 75,000 artillery rounds a day. And to put that in perspective, during the Gulf War, you know, when the United States put 500,000 troops on the ground, not an insignificant number, the total number of artillery shells we fired during the total, during all of Desert Storm was 60,000. So Russia is exceeding that amount every single day. It's a tenfold advantage over what the Ukrainians have, which means they're inflicting far more damage, far more destruction, and they're shaping the battlefield in a much more decisive way than the Ukrainians ever could. The Ukrainians have the advantage of extensive fortifications that they've been building up over the course of 8 years. They're very good at building fortifications. So what they do is they will defend a piece of terrain for as long as necessary until they've built another defensive system behind, and they'll fall back to that defensive system. The goal of the Ukrainians is to trade space for time, to trade lives for time. They're sacrificing men by time. By time for what? For them to get this heavy equipment from the West, from the United States, from NATO, to get trained on it. And they're not being trained in Ukraine, where the Russians can hit them. They're being trained in France, in Germany, in Poland. Now, Boris Johnson just flew in. He said, we're going to train you in England as well. So the goal of the Ukrainians is to reconstitute the forces that Russia has destroyed, and make the pain threshold so great for Russia that it's not able to accomplish its mission, that Russia will have to sue for peace. That doesn't mean that Ukraine defeated Russia, but Ukraine wins in that scenario by not losing, by surviving. And what we have right now is we have people in Ukraine and in the West who actually believe this is possible. This is why we saw the four leaders of the French, the Germans, Romanians, the Italians, they go to Kiev, they meet with Zelensky, and they prop him up. They promise him eventual EU membership. They promise to provide more arms, and they promise to be there for him, to support him. Boris Johnson flies in afterwards, promises to train 10,000 troops every 4 months. But this is all a pipe dream. Understand that all the equipment that NATO is providing today, and let's put it in perspective, the Ukrainians have asked for 1,000 artillery pieces. The entire inventory of the United States Army and Marine Corps put together is barely 1,000. So the Ukrainians are asking that we give them the equivalent of all the artillery in our arsenal. They're asking for 500 tanks. If you take all the tanks in England, all the tanks in Germany, you don't get 500. The Ukrainians want more tanks than the British and the Germans have. The same thing. And why are they asking for this? Because Russia's already destroyed the equivalent of that. And the Russian army isn't begging anybody for equipment. They've got it. So we're simply giving the Ukrainians equipment so that the Russians can destroy it. And the Russians will destroy it. And here's the lesson that comes out of this. Because the West has their little fantasy world. But today, or yesterday, I believe, Pushilin, the president of the Donetsk People Republic, one of the two newly independent republics that are fighting with the Russians, spoke at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum, which is an event on Russian soil hosted by the president of Russia. And I will guarantee you that he doesn't speak unless his words have been cleared by the Kremlin. And what he said is, one, the special military operation will probably end sometime by the end of this year. So anybody who thinks that this war is going to be over in a couple weeks, a couple months, no. The timeline set by the Russians is the end of the year, which means they're going to continue grinding the Ukrainians down. It's inevitable. The other thing he said is, if you think we were going to stop once we liberated our territory, you're wrong, because NATO has provided Ukraine weapons. We no longer can just stop there. We now have to complete the mission. We have to go in and destroy their military. And he also said that Russian cities will belong to Russia. And what that means is places like Kharkov, like Odessa, Dnipropetrovsk. These are where significant Russian populations are. The special military operation isn't going to end until Russia controls them all. And then he said, I don't think the Ukrainian nation will survive. Meaning that when this is done, Ukraine's going bye-bye. He also said that Zelensky will be arrested and tried as a war criminal. And the thing about the Russians saying this is that, unlike Ukraine, they have the ability to make all of this happen, and it will all happen. That's where we are today. This is a huge deal. NATO and the United States are facing the kind of moral and physical defeat at the hands of Russia that will probably mean the end of NATO. I don't think NATO survives this. That doesn't mean that they're going to dissolve tomorrow. But this on top of, you know, I think people have forgotten that just in August of last year, NATO suffered a huge humiliation, the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And NATO was struggling after that. Who are we? What are we? What are we doing? And now they've stood up to Russia to be brave against her, and they're going to lose against Russia without even fighting. By the time Russia finishes this, Russia will have an army that's the most seasoned combat experienced military in the world, facing off against NATO forces who were poorly trained, poorly led, and guess what now? Poorly equipped because they gave all their weapons away. So that's where we are in a nutshell.
Yeah, well, you don't hear that very often in the Western, especially the Western mainstream media. We've mostly been hearing, first off, that Russia is just committing this total all-out, almost a war without a cause. Like, they're just invading Ukraine. There's no reason behind it. It's just utter and sheer brutality. There's no nuance. There's no detail. Not everything that you've said basically is left out of the narrative. And then you brought up NATO. I thought that was a really interesting point. NATO's defeat, because even when not a month ago, there were attempts to for Finland and Sweden to apply and then get admitted to NATO. And then Turkey immediately was like, no, we're not going to stand for that. And it's that has seemed to fall, has fallen out of at least the public discourse for right now. But, you know, I wanted to ask you more about East Ukraine situation, right? Because this has been going on for a while. I mean, Ukraine was waging a civil war in Donbass region. You've brought this up many times about all of the casualties that have been suffered because of that war. Where is the situation now? Because one of the big demands that Ukraine has, which I find to be absolutely just totally unreasonable, is that Crimea has to be returned to Ukraine. Like, that's one of the demands that seems to be a huge barrier to any kind of negotiated settlement. Like, Russia's never going to do that. That happened. That has happened. There was a referendum. Crimea overwhelmingly decided to be in the Russian Federation. That happened, what is it, 2022? That happened 7+ years ago. So what's happening in East Ukraine? Like, what is the situation in the Donbass? Because it seems like, as you said, Russia's making huge gains there, and it's likely that a lot of those gains are actually going to go directly to Russia, that it's not going to possibly remain just simply Ukraine.
Well, let's just start with basic principles. You use the term negotiation. There will be no negotiation. None. It's not going to happen. Why? Because to negotiate, it implies that you have two parties, each of whom are bringing something to the table, and that there's going to be some horse trading going on. There'll be some compromises made, and you'll come up with a mutually acceptable solution. No, there will be unconditional surrender. Russia is fed up. Russia's done with this game. It's you know, Zelensky had an opportunity to stop this war before it began, and then even after it began, to mitigate the damage by simply acceding to Russia's demands. Now, people say, well, it's unreasonable for Russia to ask for denazification. Are there really Nazis? Is that really a thing? It's unreasonable for Russia to say you have to dismantle your military. I mean, Ukraine should be allowed to join NATO. That's not a problem. It's unreasonable to say that Ukraine has to be neutral. Well, let's just do a little quick history check. The Ukrainian nationalists under Bandera came into being in the 1920s. They considered themselves to be some sort of superior race. They aligned themselves with Nazi Germany in 1944 when Germany was defeated. The CIA began backing them in 1945. And we backed the Bandera movement because they were killing communists. And for nearly a decade, they fought a guerrilla war that ended up killing 150,000 Poles, 200,000 Russians, whom these Ukrainians view as subhumans. They were ultimately defeated militarily, but the CIA continued to fund them from 1954 up until 1990, fund their political movement. You know, there's a Bandera camp just down the road here. There's Bandera camps in Canada. The Western Ukrainians have a large diaspora in the United States and Ukraine. They're very heavily involved in politics. Many of the names from the you know, the Russiagate scandal, our Ukrainian Americans who date back to this this Western Ukrainian diaspora. And they also assisted in the resurrection of the Bandera movement, the legitimization, the mainstreaming of it in 2014 during the Maidan revolution, a violent coup against a duly elected, you know, pro-Russian president of Ukraine who was overthrown. But the important thing here, and this is why it's relevant when we talk about Eastern Ukraine, the Ukrainian nationalists, although they're a distinct minority in Ukraine, became the heartbeat of this movement, especially in terms of its violence, its anti-Russian violence. They insisted that you know, new laws be passed that not only elevated Bandera to a national hero status, but also outlawed the Russian language, outlawed Russian culture, pretty much banned Russian ethnicity. And then they violently enacted this in May of 2014. They went to Odessa, stuffed 150 Russians into a building, set it on fire. Nearly 50 of them burned to death or died of smoke inhalation. And this was part of the purging of Russians from Odessa, a Russian majority city. Then they tried to make a run on Crimea, but the little green men, the Russian soldiers, got in the way, and we know what happened in Crimea. And here's where it gets important about Eastern Ukraine. Then they moved up to the city of Mariupol, which is a Russian-dominated city on the Sea of Azov coastline. You've heard of the Azov Regiment or the Azov Battalion. These are Ukrainian neo-Nazis who took over Mariupol and created a headquarters for their movement to begin the ethnic cleansing of the Russian population in the Donbas. You called it a civil war. It's not a civil war. It's ethnic cleansing. It's genocide. That's exactly what they were doing. The trials that will come out will expose this. I don't need to get into the gory details, except to say that the Russians have in their possession the flash drives, because one thing we know about rapists and murderers is they like to film their crimes and then brag about them amongst each other. They share them. So the Russians have captured the thumb drives with all of the crimes perpetrated, the rapes, the murders against men, women, children. This will come out at trial when they put these thousands of captured Nazis on trial. But these Nazis were there. They started a conflict that, you know, led the Russian population to declare independence. And here's an important fact. When the Russian population of Donetsk and Lugansk declared independence, Russia wouldn't recognize it. Russia said, no, you're part of Ukraine. So anybody who says Russia is a land grab by Russia, no. Crimea wasn't a land grab. Crimea was a self-defense bag. Crimea is Russian, an accident of history that it ever became part of Ukraine. But the Donbas, the Russian government said, no, that is part of Ukraine, and it will stay part of Ukraine. We will defend the Russians. We'll defend their rights, but we're not going to allow them to leave Ukraine. So an 8-year conflict began. 14,000 people, 14 to 16,000 people were killed, many of them children. You might remember the speech given by a guy named Poroshenko. He was a president of Ukraine, where he bragged on national TV that while Ukrainian children go to school and go to the park and play, the Russian children in the Donbas will be cowering in their basements because we'll be bombing them every single day. That's a heck of a man there, Poroshenko. But what the other thing that's important about him is, you know, Russia tried to have a peace process. They actually sat down with France and Germany in something called the Normandy format, and in a peace accord called the Minsk Accords in 2015 were agreed upon. And all the Ukrainians had to do was implement it, which meant simply providing a special autonomous status for the Russians in the Donbas so that they could speak their language, their culture would be preserved, but they're still part of Ukraine. Now, for 7 years, Ukraine didn't sign it. They always said, well, we have problems. We were forced into this treaty. We didn't want to do it. And the Germans and the French never really pressured them to do it. Well, Poroshenko, there's that name again, he came out and he just admitted Minsk was the Minsk Accords was a sham. We signed it knowing we were never going to implement it. And here's the important thing. We signed it to buy time so that we could build up our military so that we could take the Donbas and Crimea back. Now, why is this important? Because in 2015, the same year that the Minsk Accords were signed, the United States and NATO began training the Ukrainian military. The United States was training 5 battalions of Ukrainian forces a year to NATO standards. And then there's this wonderful little slide where they brag about it. They say, we train them here in this Western Ukrainian training thing, and then they have an arrow so they can go here and kill Russians. This is America bragging about it. We're training 5 battalions of Ukrainian troops to NATO standards so they can go to East Ukraine and kill Russians. So that's 40 battalions that we trained. That's a lot of battalions, by the way. And this puts in perspective why Russia is so angry at NATO, because this isn't a defensive alliance. NATO is empowering the Ukrainians to lie diplomatically about the Minsk agreements, knowing that the Ukrainians will never implement it, even though we say we want them to buy time so that NATO can train Ukraine to build a military to kill Russians. And so when Putin went across the border, orders troops across the border on February 24th, everybody said, well, this is an irrational land grab by a power-hungry madman. No, this was an act of legitimate self-defense by the leader of the Russian people, who was fed up with the lies, the murdering, the duplicity of not just Ukraine and their Nazi militants, but NATO, who was actively training and arming the Nazis. So that's the situation in East Ukraine. And I think what's going to happen now is we're going to find that Russia will never allow the Ukrainian government, whatever's left of it, to hold sway over significant Russian populations ever again. It will not happen. So Ukraine is going to lose a lot of territory, and they're going to lose it forever. It will never go back to Ukraine. That's the reality of the situation on the ground in eastern Ukraine right now.
Yeah, well, thanks for that analysis. I mean, it just seems like this is something that could drag on for a very long time. And in the way that the United States is behaving, I want to get your opinion on this, because we talk about here on this show all the time about the United States' approach to the world. But in this case, right, this is a conflict with Russia that over and over again, the Biden administration kind of speaks out of two sides of its mouth, where it says, no, we're not trying to antagonize Russia, but we want to make sure Russia is weakened so it can't meet its objectives in Ukraine. Like it says both at the same time. Is this a U.S. proxy war with Russia? Like, is this an attempt to confront Russia primarily and principally? Because it seems like all indications, the way that the United States has behaved, this is going to be a huge, this is probably going to be, if the Biden administration makes it out of one term, if it runs in, this will be a huge part of its legacy. Is this kind of the end game that the Biden administration is imagining, a confrontation with Russia? Because I think most, sane people who have any kind of rationality would say that's incredibly reckless. But at the same time, the pumping of Ukraine with all of this military aid, what is this, $56 billion in last 4 months or something or around that. I mean, and in all of the details you gave about what that weaponry is and what they're going to do with it. I mean, yeah, what's your opinion on that? This idea that the U.S.'s endgame here is a confrontation with Russia. It seems unthinkable.
Yeah. Well, it's not just, it's of course it should be unthinkable, but the point is it's happening. You know, one of the things that, that the United States is very good at, unfortunately, is looking in a mirror and projecting what we do onto others. Do you remember just last year, the Russian bounty on American servicemen in Afghanistan?
Right.
Oh my
right.
God, the Russians are going to pay the Afghans to kill Americans. This is disgusting. This is despicable. It was a lie. It never happened. But Now let's reflect on the United States training Ukrainian troops for the sole purpose of going to the Donbas to kill Russians. That's real. That did happen. And hundreds, if not thousands, of Russians died. Americans were getting upset because maybe two or three American service members were killed in a car bomb done by the Taliban, who may have taken a bounty from somebody who might have been affiliated with Russia. It turned out to be a lie. Two or three. Now, I'm not minimizing that. I'm saying, it's American life. It's precious. We're killing thousands of Russians using Ukrainian troops that we trained and equipped for the sole purpose of killing Russians. So right off the bat, you have to understand that the United States has never told the truth about what its objectives are, and it is doing the worst thing possible. You remember, 2016, 2020, Russiagate? Those Russians are trying to steal the election. They're interfering with our processes, And then Joe Biden, of course, with a slip of the tongue in Warsaw, that man has to go. Are you really saying that American policy is regime change? No, we're not saying. Yes, we are. But it isn't just, Biden coming up, the Biden administration. Understand that Joe Biden is an extension in many ways of the Obama administration. And if you study, most Americans, have sort of skipped over history. There used to be a thing called the Soviet Union. We used to be scared of them because they were big and bad, mean and ugly. They were the evil empire. But then we got along with them. And we made friends with them, but then they went away. And then instead of helping what remained, as friends would do, we danced on their grave. We declared victory. We called them defeated enemy. And in the decade of the 90s, we basically raped Russia. I hate to use that word. It's an ugly word. But we economically and politically raped Russia. We installed one of the weakest, most worthless political figures in Russian history, Boris Yeltsin, drunk, a corrupt man. I always love it where, the Russians interfered in our election by buying $120,000 worth of Facebook ads. Wow, that changed everything. Well, in 1996, Time magazine had a cover that bragged, America bought the election in Russia. Boris Yeltsin was on the way out. He was useless. Nobody liked him. We went in and literally bought the election, bought it. We brought in campaign advisors. We did the whole campaign. We paid for it. We bribed people. We stole. We made sure votes weren't counted so that our man, our boy, Boris Yeltsin, stayed in power. Why? Because we were empowering a class of people called the oligarchs. These are robber thieves, robber barons. Who stole Soviet state property, made it their own, and were throwing billions of dollars offshore into banks in Europe and the United States. They're buying property, and we loved it. We loved this money coming in. So we wanted to keep them in place. We wanted to keep Russia weak. We just enjoyed humiliating Russia. In 1999, there was a phone call between Bill Clinton and Boris Yeltsin, and two issues were discussed. One was NATO expansion, and Yeltsin begged Clinton not to do it. He said, it's just going to cause me so many problems. And Clinton just ignored him, laughed, blew it off. And the other one was the bombing of Kosovo, or of Serbia, a Russian ally. He said, don't do it. My military is very mad at me right now. Clinton blew it off, bombed it anyways. The phone call is not that important. What's important is the guy that was listening alongside Yeltsin as Clinton abused the president of Russia. His name was Vladimir Putin. And that year, Yeltsin finally stepped down and he appointed Putin to be his replacement. The thing about Vladimir Putin is that he wasn't Boris Yeltsin. He's not corrupt. He's not an alcoholic. He's a man who believes in Russia. And he became president, and almost immediately the United States became worried because they realized that here is a man who believed in a strong Russia, and we didn't want a strong Russia. We wanted a weak Russia. This is a man who, was going to reinvent Russia. He wasn't going to be Boris Yeltsin. At first, George W. Bush, remember he met with him? I looked into his eyes and I saw his soul. That's amazing, George. You're an amazing guy. And I said, this is a man I can work with. What he should have said is, I looked into his eyes and I saw a guy who is patriotic, believes in his country, is going to make sure that his country is elevated to the status it deserves. Not ruler of the world. They're not trying to be America, but to be Russia, a big nation, a powerful nation, a proud nation. And what did we do to Russia during that time? Russia said, hey, we take arms control seriously. We'd like not to get into an arms race with you. So why don't we ratify these strategic treaties? Why don't we strengthen ABM, the anti-ballistic missile treaties, the foundation of arms control? Why don't we get the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty back in the shape? What did we do? We withdrew from the ABM treaty. We ignored them on the START treaty. We said, you're weak. We don't need to worry about you. We're just going to press for the unilateral strategic advantage of the United States. And Putin sat back and listened to that. In 2007, Putin gave one of the greatest speeches in modern history. It was at the Munich Security Conference. And I would encourage everybody listening to this to go and Google Putin, Munich, 2007. Listen to the speech, but better, listen to the question and answer period afterwards, where he just lays into the Western leaders. It is one of the best pieces of political oratory that you're ever going to hear. And it shows that this man is on top of his game. But one of the things he said is that he doesn't want NATO to expand, that he thinks it's, that we need to be talking about a new European security framework. But just a year later, NATO voted to allow Ukraine and Georgia in. And what's important about this, that's 2008. The then ambassador to the United to Russia, a guy named William Burns, wrote a memorandum called "Niet means Niet, No means No," and it defined the Russian red line. And it said basically that if NATO continues to push for Ukrainian membership, eventually Russia will have no choice but to go to war. And when Russia goes to war, Ukraine will lose Crimea and the Donbas. This was written in 2009, February of 2009. So we knew what the consequences were going to be, but we ignored it. We pressed forward. Barack Obama became president. And here's where it gets important, because Obama came in and he had an advisor named Michael McFaul. Michael McFaul started off as the head of the Russia desk for the National Security Council. And he came up with something he called the reset. We're going to reset relations with Russia. But what the reset really was regime change. What reset means, because here's what happened. The Russian Constitution only allows the president to have two consecutive terms. After that point, he has to step down. Well, Putin had served his two consecutive terms. So what Putin did is a nice little trick where he swapped places with the prime minister named Dmitry Medvedev. Medvedev became president, Putin became prime minister. And so what McFaul said to Obama is, why don't we work to elevate Medvedev as the great man? Yeah. We'll make him the savior. We'll do all those things we wouldn't do with Putin. We're going to do with Medvedev, and we're going to push Putin out. We're going to push this Russian patriot out, this guy who believes in the strong Russia. We're going to push him away, and Medvedev is going to become our new Boris Yeltsin. That was the strategy. They called it a reset. It was regime change. It didn't work. And in 2011, they were getting ready to do the flip. Putin was going to come back and become president. And a guy named Joe Biden, might ring a bell, flies to Moscow in March of 2011, where he meets in Moscow with Russian opposition figures. And he tells them that it would be a good idea if Putin didn't run for president again, because that would be bad for Putin and bad for Russia. Now, could you imagine Vladimir Putin flying to the United States in 6 months before a national election and telling Joe Biden, it would be a bad idea for Joe Biden to run for election, re-election. It would be bad for Biden, bad for America. We'd be up in arms. So what are you doing trying to come here to change our election, interfere? Because that is literally direct interference. Biden said it. Putin ignored it, ran for president, won. But that victory that Putin, with Putin back in power, that changed everything. because now our soft regime change policy failed. Now our hard regime change policy comes in. And the hard regime change policy is built around the premise that we can destroy Russia's economy and inflict so much harm on the Russian people that they will push Putin out of power and replace him with, again, the modern day incarnation of Boris Yeltsin. So when we talk about this conflict in Ukraine, understand that a key aspect of this conflict was economic sanctions, which were designed to deter Russia from invasion. Economic sanctions that if Russia invaded would cause so much harm that that Russia would forever be changed. That was what, that was the purpose. The sanctions policy that was put in place by the United States and Europe had nothing to do with Ukraine. You have to understand that. It was all about regime change. The purpose of the sanctions program was to destroy the Russian economy, inflict so much harm on the Russian people that they would rise up and remove Vladimir Putin from power. Well, Putin is probably the smartest man on the planet. And when Joe Biden met with him in June of 2021 in Geneva, Switzerland, and stared him in the eyes, I think American presidents like to stare people in the eyes, and told him straight up, "We will do immeasurable harm to the Russian economy if you invade Ukraine." Putin said, "Hey, thank you very much for the tip." Went back, got his boys to come up with a counter plan. And guess whose economy is tanking today? It ain't Russia. It's ours. It's Europe. He's reversed it. The regime change plan has failed. Putin is stronger today than he has ever been. And he's in a better position geopolitically than he has ever been. But to come down to the basic question that you asked, is the United States, does it have a policy of hurting Russia, hurting Putin? Yes, that's the only policy we have. I mean, this is, so now I'm going to give away something here. I'm working on an article. It's going to take me some time to write it because it's in-depth analysis. But my article is a suggestion to U.S. policymakers. Vladimir Putin is in his late 60s. He's not going to be around forever. And the United States needs to stop worrying about getting rid of Vladimir Putin and start worrying about what's going to happen when Putin eventually stops being the strong leader that he is. And maybe it's in the best interest of the United States to actually undertake what I call a hands-off approach on Russia, to allow Vladimir Putin to build a Russian system capable of breathing life into a political figure who can successfully inherit Russia from Putin. Right now, Putin can manage Russia, but if Putin died today, there's not anybody in Russia that can do what Putin's doing. And Russia would devolve into chaos. And there's a lot of people in the United States that that's what we want. No, it's not what we want. That world has ended. Putin gave a great speech today in St. Mm-hmm. Petersburg, where he said that the day of of the American unilateral power is over. It's past. And that's true. And it's better for us to allow Russia to develop as a nation, to develop the kind of institutional governance systems that that can keep Russia functioning as a competent nation in a post-Putin environment. That's what our national security objective should be right now. Not a weak Russia, but a strong Russia. Not a strong Russia that threatens us, but a strong Russia capable of working with us bring some global stability. But we don't think like that. We have people who are so ignorant about Russia. I call them Putin whisperers. They've spent the last 20 years doing nothing but writing PhD theses about how bad Vladimir Putin is. They don't know anything about Russian history, Russian culture. They don't know anything about Vladimir Putin. They just created this cartoon character that unfortunately American political leaders have bought into and the American public has bought into.
Yeah, no. It sounds like you're describing Michael McFaul to almost to a T. You talk about ignorance on all of that.
We're on McFaul. Sorry to interrupt, but since we're on him, he just did a panel I think, with a gentleman named Mearsheimer, a very, very esteemed academic of the realist school. And Mearsheimer was questioning our distinguished former U.S. ambassador to Russia about, you know, what the U.S. was telling Ukraine to do. And long story short, it came out that the U.S. was lying to Ukraine. And Mearsheimer asked McFaul straight up, "So we lied to Ukraine?" And McFaul, the distinguished diplomat, distinguished ambassador, said, "Yes, of course we did. Of course we lied. It's the real world. That's what we do." Newsflash, Michael McFaul. Credible diplomats don't lie. You see, that's why they're diplomats. That's why they become ambassadors. They've learned the art of shading the truth, but never being called out in an absolute lie. Because once you do that, you lose all credibility. You are nothing. Michael McFaul basically just threw the American diplomatic service under the bus by saying what he said. And I don't think he realized just how wrong it was what he did. American ambassadors are the representatives of the United States of America, of the American people to other countries. And if your whole premise is that we lie, how is the world ever going to trust us ever again? Who would enter a treaty relationship with us? Who would enter an economic agreement with us? Because Michael McFaul just said, it's the real world. We lie. No, we don't. The CIA lies. That's what they do. But diplomats don't lie. They can't lie. They don't have to tell the truth, meaning you don't have to sit there and give away all your cards. But that's where you learn to have a poker face. That's where you've gone to school, so you've learned how to spin words very carefully and very cleverly so that you're saying something without lying and you're hiding the meaning. That's the art of diplomacy. But you don't lie. You don't straight out tell a lie. Michael McFaul did, and he's not even ashamed of it. Anyways, I just wanted to throw
that out. I mean, it reminds me of also William Burns. You brought up the truth that he spoke right in the early 90s about the risk of NATO expansion. Now he's a CIA director, and he doesn't say anything. So you see the difference between what it means to be in the position he was in to be.
But in defense of William Burns, I'm not normally in the business of defending CIA directors, but Burns built a reputation as a diplomat for what's called back channel diplomacy. Because again, we come to the real world. The real world is, let's say you and I have a diplomatic disagreement. I can't lie to you and you can't lie to me, but we can't tell the truth either. So we're dancing around, we're not getting anywhere, we're stonewalling, we're this, that, and the other thing, but we need a breakthrough. But we can't do it publicly because I don't want to be embarrassed, you don't want to be embarrassed. We have people like William Burns, who is very good at opening up the back channel, meeting with your deputy over coffee in some cafe that nobody would ever see, and hashing out a solution behind the scenes, the back channel. I think he wrote a book called The Back Channel that describes this. And the reason why he was selected as the CIA director isn't that he's a master practitioner of espionage. He's not. He's a diplomat. It's because the CIA has, in recent history, become a back channel for diplomacy because of the security relationships that we establish with different countries. And because intelligence services are pretty good, in theory, of keeping things secret. So, for instance, if let's say right now Anthony Blinken and Sergey Lavrov just can't talk to each other because they've already said too many things and they can't. And, Lloyd Austin can't sit down with Shoigu because they've done the same thing. They've pissed each other, made each other angry and all that. Well, William Burns can sit down in some offsite faraway place with the head of the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service. And they can have a frank and open discussion. They can say things they think can be relayed back to Shoigu, Lavrov, Blinken, and Austin, and they can keep the diplomacy alive. I don't know that that's what William Burns is doing, but I would tell you this. If I was in Vegas, I'd put an awful lot of money on that bet, because that's why he was brought in. That's his strength. And I will bet a dime to a dollar that William Burns is engaged in some sort of creative back channel diplomacy to try and provide an off ramp. But there's another problem here. It's called the Congress of the United States. We have demonized Russia so much, to such an extent, that, you know, even if Burns was able to come up with a rational, logical plan to prevent, you know, the U.S.-Russian relations from coming to a head, Congress is not able to accept this, because Congress isn't in the business of doing good things for America. Congress is in the business of doing good things for Congress, especially individual members of Congress who are running for re-election. And politicians don't normally survive an election bid if they've spent their entire tenure saying one thing and then right before the election saying, nope, I'm doing a 180 degree flip and this is another thing. They've been beating up on Russia, suddenly say, no, we want to be friends with Russia. The electorate, you know, it's something I was told by a general once when I was standing in front of his desk explaining why I did what I did. I believed I was right. I was right. But I was in front of a general explaining. He said, Ritter, when you're explaining, you're losing. Get the hell out of my desk. So the fact that the moment you have to explain something to somebody, you've lost. Because it means that you haven't done it right leading up to that moment. That there should not be a necessity to explain it, because you've been doing it right. It'll be understood by everybody. But you have to stand in front of people and explain why you're doing something, you've lost. In Congress right now, if they were ever going to accept some sort of creative diplomatic solution to the Russia problem, we're doing a lot of explaining to their constituents, and Congress doesn't want to be doing that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It's very interesting. I want to pivot back to something you said, and then perhaps end on an article you recently wrote. I think it was published today in the Global Times about Taiwan and China. But first, I want to ask you, because you said something very interesting that I really think should be expounded on, is you said that it is in the U.S.'s interest for Russia to be strong, to be sovereign, independent, and stable. To summarize. And what's interesting about that is, I think in the cases of Russia and China, I think both countries have had for many, many, many years now a policy of wanting strong relations with the United States. I mean, it's no secret China's economic relationship with the United States. Russia, I mean, it wasn't too long ago when Russia was asking to be in military alliances with the United States. But the United States, as you said, doesn't see things like that. And I think some of the benefits of course, I guess in an ideal world of the U.S., China, Russia all working together, is the world is a very chaotic place right now. You have a lot of poverty. You have climate change. You have wars all over. I mean, most of them the U.S. is at the root of. But the point is that there's a lot of conflict. There's a lot of suffering. And there's a lot that could be worked out and managed and perhaps addressed if these major powers now were not at war with each, or we're not at war with each other, really. We're not in open conflict. Some call it a new Cold War, but this is really, as you said, with Russia, it is really a war against Russia, what the United States is waging. And I would argue the same with China, with Taiwan, is that there is, and just in the Asia Pacific generally, I mean, that's that huge buildup is no secret about what it's for. I mean, it can't be anything but war. And you said you read my mind. I was going to ask you about Putin's speech at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, because when he said, I mean, that's a very strong statement to say the old world order is gone. It's over. That period is ended. And I think all of the benefits of these countries working together speak to that. And I wanted to ask you, though, what do you think is the impediment? Because what is getting in the way? And really, I mean, my politics are, I see the United States as the big impediment here, how the United States is behaving. I don't see anything on China's side or Russia's side that really is a block. So what is the impediment for the United States to do what is rational, right? Mersheimer is a realist. He's looking for rational policy, but we're not seeing that from the United States. What is the big impediment here?
Well, the first of all, let's just start off with a couple. You know, again, I like to have foundational concepts before we move forward. Russia's in the business of promoting Russia. China's in the business of promoting China. And we shouldn't pretend that these are, you know, philanthropic nations that are willing to sacrifice everything for the common good of everybody. No, they're selfish, just like everybody else is. But here's the difference. Imagine King Arthur's Round Table. And all the knights of the realm come together around there. And why did they make the round table? Because they wanted everybody to be equal. But imagine that there's two doors that come into the round table. One that everybody else comes into all together. They you know, after you, sir, after you, boom, boom, boom. They're all equal. And they come around the table. And then one where the king comes in. And the king comes in, he sits down, and he's got Excalibur, and he starts the meeting. And everybody listens to the king. That's the way the world has been running since the end of the Second World War, where we have a table where everybody sits at, but there's one chair that's higher than the others with Excalibur and the king, and that's the United States. And because the realm revolves around the king, everything has to be to the benefit of the king and the realm. What I mean is it's a zero-sum game. The king can't get into a interaction with somebody where there's trade-offs, because from the king's perspective, when he's given something away, that means he's lost. The king only wants to win. The king only wants to absorb. The king doesn't want to trade. And that's been the United States approach to running the world since the end of the Second World War. When we speak of a rules-based international order, what we're saying is it's the United States calling the shot, making the world work in a manner which is to the benefit of the United States. Others may get some residual benefit, but what's happening isn't designed to make other people happy. It's designed to make us happy. And what Putin said is that day is over. That's the door that the king used to come in has been shut. The chair that the king used to sit on, the throne, has been cut down and replaced with a normal chair. And the United States now has to come in through the same entrance as everybody else. And now when the United States engages in, you know, the interaction, there will be give and take, meaning that the United States no longer dictates the day of the rules-based international order, i.e. preserving American hegemony, is finished. It's now the law-based international order with the United Nations Charter reigning supreme. That's where we're at today. So the United States is still going to be sitting at the table. I mean, when they say that it's over, this doesn't mean America goes away. We're still a huge country, very powerful country, very powerful economy. We can make things happen, but we're no longer dictating outcomes. We now have to work with the world to come up with a cooperative solution, which is why I said it's in our best interest to have a strong, stable Russia. Because Russia is one of the principal, you know, energy providers of the world, food providers of the world. The base, and we're learning this now. It's almost like an American economist never opened up a book. We're going, what? Russia produces all that fertilizer? Oh, and if we sanction the fertilizer, food doesn't grow around the world. Oh my! Russia makes all this wheat, and if we say they can't sell the wheat, we go hungry. Oh my! And Russia does all this energy, and if they, oh my, we freeze to death. It's like we forgot what Russia does, just like we don't respect what China does and what China brings to the table. You know, so, you know, I the United States is going to have to learn how to be one of many as opposed to just being one.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be a really painful process. Oh, yeah. Experience getting there, as we are already seeing the fruits of this hubris, this ignorance, this real unilateral aggression, what it's bringing to the U.S.'s economy, what it's bringing to ordinary people. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous right now, and no one's happy. And so of course, the politics, the political situation in the U.S. is in very dire straits. But I wanted to pivot. Maybe this could be where we close. Your recent article in the Global Times is titled "U.S. Policymakers Caught in Hubris-Driven Ignorance Trap Over the Taiwan Question." So there's some overlapping themes here. I mean, with how the U.S. is treating Russia with regard to the U.S.'s approach to Taiwan. Could you maybe just expound on what your argument is there? And yeah, what exactly is the U.S.'s endgame with Taiwan? Because it seems like, I mean, if we're talking about a catastrophic confrontation with Russia, I can't think of anything more catastrophic than a confrontation with China, given its capabilities and where it sits in the world today.
Yeah, I mean, again, fundamentals. There was a time when the United States supported the nationalist Chinese, the Kuomintang, Chiang Kai-shek. And we supported them, and at the end of the Second World War, we actually got them elevated to Security Council status, one of the five major powers that were victorious in the conflict. Then a funny thing happened on the way to church. In 1949, the communists overthrew the nationalist Chinese, and Chiang Kai-shek and his Kuomintang, and I'm probably saying that wrong, fled to Taiwan, the island of Formosa off the coast of China, where Mao Zedong and the Communist Party took over China. And the United States, for a while, because we were in a hot conflict with China, remember Korea, we actually were engaged in actual combat operations against China. And then we had the Cold War with China. So we supported Taiwan through the Cold War. And, Taiwan basically believed that it was the legitimate government of all of China, and that they were looking for a time when they could overthrow the Communist Party and reestablish control. That turned out to be a fantasy. And by 1971, the rest of the world finally realized that, Taiwan, you got to get out of the Security Council. We're putting the big boys in. Chinese communists are invited to come in. And that shift took a place at the time. Not only was China being elevated on the world stage, but there was some important rifts developing between communist China and the Soviet Union over, China didn't like being dictated to by the Soviets about global communist policy. China wanted to develop its own independent nuclear capability. Russia wasn't helping. There's just, some disagreements. And then there were some border issues where they were, actual fights between Soviet and Chinese troops along the border. And so in 1972, Richard Nixon flew to China and changed history. We established diplomatic relations with China. We began engaging in active trade with China. And in 1979, as a reflection of this, we had to alter our policy because China wasn't going to stand by and let us continue to pretend that Taiwan is the big player. So the United States Congress passed something called the Taiwan Act of 1979. And in it, we embraced two things. One, something called the One China policy. That means that we don't believe in two Chinas. There's not a Taiwan. There's not a China. There's one China policy, and that Taiwan is part of China. We also believed in the peaceful reunification of the two, and that in order to ensure the peaceful reunification, we would assist Taiwan in having enough defense to deter any effort by the communist Chinese to violently reabsorb Taiwan. So, and this turned into a policy of what's called strategic ambiguity, where we sort of let it hang out there that we would assist the Taiwanese if they were attacked, but we didn't say it right up front because We didn't want to encourage Taiwan declaring independence on the mistaken belief that the United States would be there to help them. Key to this was the notion that we would, that through the economic improvement of economic relations, that China would transform from this autocratic communist centric nation into sort of free market capitalism, democracy. It would be like us. They would, you know, they think like us, dress like us, talk like us. It just wouldn't look like us. But, you know, hey, that's the Chinese. No, we don't care. It didn't happen. The Chinese actually retained their, you know, communist nature. And then they did something really embarrassing. They took capitalism and made it work. And on a big scale, they did interesting things like run successive 5-year plans where they pulled 300 million people at a time out of poverty into the middle class status. They actually built infrastructure that works. They have high speed trains that operate from clean stations efficiently. And you know, basically, China's doing it better than we do it. They've built through something called the Belt and Roads Initiative. They've built trade relationships with the world that have helped bring the Chinese economy into the world's great economic engine, controlling supply chains, access to resources. They've outmaneuvered the United States. Barack Obama tried to, you know, pivot to the Pacific to counter China. And he came up with something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And it was supposed to be this wonderful alliance of free trade association of everybody in the Pacific except China. China wasn't invited to play.
No.
Okay, so he bullied everybody, cajoled everybody, got them all on board. Donald Trump came in and looked at it and said, nah, I'm out of here. He pulled the plug and the TPP went away. What did China do? They came in, picked up the pieces, built it all together, and made it even bigger. And now China's part of it, and America's not part of it. This is the sort of thing that's been going on with China outflanking us. And at some point in time in the United States, we realized that China, without firing a shot, has taken over the Pacific. They are the dominant power in the Pacific. And now we need to come up with a strategy that reverses this, that preserves American dominance in the Pacific, because the Pacific has always been an American lake, especially after the end of the Second World War. But we can't do it economically because we just proved that the Chinese beat us hands down every time we go. So what are we going to do to the Chinese? Enter Taiwan. We have now began a process of encouraging the Taiwanese government not to unify with China, leading them to believe that they can be strong enough to repel any Chinese attack because America will be there to help, which means that strategic ambiguity is no longer ambiguous. It means that, and we saw it again with Joe Biden's slip of the tongue. What if China attacks Taiwan? America will come to its defense because that's what we're obligated to do. Well, no, we're not, unless there's a secret annex that we don't know about. There is. You know, Amy Klobuchar, Tammy Duckworth, I'm sorry. Tammy Duckworth flies in, and she's sponsoring legislation, which, if implemented, would allocate hundreds of millions of dollars to put on Taiwanese soil pre-positioned American military equipment that American troops would fly in and marry up with. I will tell you right now, China will never allow this to happen because China, you know, we have the 1979 Taiwan Act. China has the 2005 Anti-Secession Act, a law. It's part of their constitution. And it says China wants to peacefully reunite with Taiwan, and we will take as long as possible to do this. But the moment Taiwan acts as if it's independent, or the moment some other nation comes in and treats it as it's independent, then we will immediately implement non-peaceful measures. We're at that stage right now. This is the scary part, and America hasn't woken up to it. The senior diplomat, last name Wang, called Tony Blinken and told him to STFU. I won't say what it means, but I'm pretty sure. But basically, just shut up. Stop talking. Quit saying what you're saying because it's insane. And we aren't going to tolerate it. You are speaking the language of war. And this isn't theoretical. You know, the Chinese ambassador to the United States in January, I think January 28th, gave an interview with National Public Radio where he said, you know, if the United States continues to behave vis-a-vis Taiwan the way it is, it's probable we will be going to war with the United States over. The Chinese ambassador is saying this to an American media outlet, saying we're going to go to war with you if you continue. That's unprecedented. It's never happened before. He's saying that now. Biden made his slip. Blinken says stupid things. Austin says stupid things because we are literally governed by stupid people, and so. Their senior national security guy calls Jake Sullivan and tells him the same thing. Shut up. Stop talking. You guys are literally creating the case for war. Wang called Blinken. And now the Chinese defense minister has come out and said, guys, we're going to go to war. We're going to blast you to smithereens. It's going to happen. I don't know. And America's just sitting there going, they don't mean it. They're bluffing. Well, I think the one harsh lesson of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine is that Vladimir Putin don't bluff. And we're about to learn another lesson, that President Xi Jinping don't bluff. China, I believe, maybe even by the end of this year, is going to invade Taiwan. It's going to be an extraordinarily brutal military incursion. It's going to be faster than anything we can possibly imagine. It's going to kill tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Taiwanese. And if the United States attempts to intercede, we will lose our fleet. And then the question is, what do we do? What happens when an American aircraft carrier with 6,000 Americans goes underwater? Does America just sit back and go, oh, okay? Or do we respond by inflicting similar pain on China? Maybe dropping a nuke on a Chinese port or a Chinese city.
It seems like the only way.
And then what does China do once one of its cities been nuked? They take out Los Angeles. They take out Seattle. And then what do we do once we lose big West Coast city? We take out, and suddenly the world ends. All because we are so stupid about China's national security interests, and we don't understand China. Let me tell you what I think. Again, I'm not going to pretend that I'm a Chinese expert. But I believe right now that if I were put in charge of U.S.-China relations, that I could convene in Macau or some semi-neutral territory a meeting of the Chinese Communist Party and the Taiwanese, and I could come up with a peaceful solution that incorporated Taiwan into China and had Taiwan retain its independent political character and have Taiwan continue to function economically and socially the way it's doing today, so that there'd be zero disruption to the Taiwanese people. It would resolve this problem whatsoever. And more importantly, put the United States at the table with China as a friend. And now we could sit there with the Chinese and say, hey, I know you guys sort of outmaneuvered us on that trade thing, but you know, it's hurting us. We're hurting. And so we need to talk about how we can lessen our pain and that's called diplomacy. And we treat the Chinese as equals. We all go through the same door. We all sit down around the same round table and we all talk about mutually beneficial arrangements where one party's not trying to take everything for themselves. Where they say, hey, we can make this work for everybody. I could do that today, right now, because the Chinese want to do that. They don't want to go to war over Taiwan. The senior Chinese officials have said that we lose everything if we invade Taiwan. We lose everything. Any advantage we wanted to get, we lost. Our economy will be shattered. Our standing in the world will be shattered. But we have to do that because Taiwan is China and we can't allow it not to be China. The United States, again, we don't know how to behave as a member of a team. We only understand how to be King Arthur with Excalibur dictating to the round table how the world should work. We don't know how to be a knight of the round table sitting around as equals with others trying to peacefully coexist. And we're going to have to learn that, or we're going to find ourselves involved in the conflict with China that will be far worse than anybody can possibly imagine. I don't give the Russian incursion into Ukraine, I give a zero chance of going nuclear. Zero. A U.S.-Chinese conflict over Taiwan, I give a 70% chance of going nuclear. That means the world ends. I hope people understand that, that the world will literally end. Go watch, you know, there's a couple movie, but, you know, On the Beach. Go watch On the Beach. You can watch the old classic black and white version or the new modern color version. Either one ends the same. Everybody dies. There will be no survivors. That's just what happens when you have global thermonuclear warfare. And that's the direction we're heading because the United States is governed by stupid people, elected by stupid citizens who don't know anything about the world they live in. I'm sorry. The American people, I love them. I'm one of them. I'm willing to die for them. But collectively, we are the most ignorant people in the world about the world we live in. We don't understand this world. Hell, we don't even understand ourselves. I'll leave you with this. My wife is a naturalized U.S. citizen. She had to take a test to become a citizen on the Constitution of the United States. Document that I took an oath up and defend against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I will bet you again, a dime to a dollar, that if we offered that test right now to every single naturally born American citizen who waves the flag and says, USA, USA, 90% would fail that test. Now, you know what happens to a non-native born American who fails that test? They don't become a citizen. Imagine if we gave you a test on the Constitution and you failed and we said, hey, let me take that passport back. You ain't a citizen anymore. Citizenship is, in the United States, it's a gift. It's a gift. It's an honor. It's a privilege. We can't take it away from you. You were given it by being born. But man, you've got to earn it. You got to earn it. And we're not earning it. And as a result, we end up with stupidity like this, what's going on with U.S.-Chinese relationships.
Yeah, no, I think that's a note that we can end on. And I think it's a real message to those, especially those, I mean, the polls are there that show that, I mean, one of the big reasons why Biden and Congress can have this kind of hubris around this too, is that polls show, at least among voters, it shows that there are more than half of people willing to support this disastrous this disastrous potentiality that you outlined, right? The U.S. saying that it will defend Taiwan from China if China intervenes, in all of the things. I mean, I don't think there's awareness of all of the things that you outlined that would happen afterward, but there is that support, and it is based on this ignorance, this profound ignorance of history and the profound ignorance of the geopolitical realities. But Scott, thank you so much for coming on. We're going to end the stream now. Before I go, please do leave with a like. Make sure you've subscribed to this channel, and be sure to support this channel and my work at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong to help sustain it. Scott, where can people find you?
I've got a very limited... I was kicked off of Twitter, so
yes, I was going to say that you were. I'm on my last strike. So
are you? Well, I was doing well on Twitter, but I'm off. I'm on Telegram now. I'm still trying to learn how to make Telegram work, but I think it's you know, Scott Ritter. And it's got my ugly face with a hat and sunglasses on there. I guess I found out. Imitation is the greatest form of flattery. There's a lot of fake Scott Ritter accounts out there, but so the real one just shows my ugly face with some sunglasses and a hat, and I post my material there. And then I opened up a discussion forum, so if I post an article, then people are able to like a separate chat room or something. So I'm trying to learn how to interact and be more responsive. I'm just not as comfortable with Telegram format as I was with Twitter, but I'll learn. I'm an old dog. You can teach me at least one new trick.
Right. I'm actually going to, I'm on your Telegram. So I'm actually going to share both of, I also am now on Telegram because I do not trust that Twitter will allow me to stay on very much longer. So I'm actually going to put that in the chat before we depart. So both those links are there for all of you to follow. Anyway, it was great to be with all of you tonight. Thanks again, Scott. And I will let you know when I'm back on live. Got some family stuff to take care of. But thanks so much again. And take care. Good night.